Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at spilalkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 48 of Real Talk. This week, I have podcast legend Chris Powers of the Fort Podcast, founder of Fort Capital, on. I was on his podcast a few months ago. He was generous enough to come on to mine. It was an honor to have him on, and we have a wide-ranging conversation on the state of the industrial market, specifically in DFW, where he focuses his acquisitions, Class B Industrial. We talk about, you know, his rise to podcast fame and how he's grown his company to the state that it's in today. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Chris Powers.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I'm here with my good friend, Chris Powers of Fort Capital. Chris, how you doing?
Man, I'm doing great. How are you doing? I'm excited to be here with you today.
I'm excited for you to come on. And I know we were talking in the virtual green room that to have you come on to my podcast, I feel like I just invited LeBron James or Michael Jordan to play basketball with my seven-year-old son. I'm giddy with excitement that I have a true celebrity on the podcast.
My man. Well, I'm not LeBron James, but I'm going to give you as much as I'm going to work as hard as I can today to be like LeBron James.
Oh, well, I'll let you know if you are as good as LeBron at the end of this podcast. But I'm just curious with your podcast prowess, how many times a week or maybe even many times a day does someone come up and say, Chris, I saw or listened to one of your podcasts?
If I'm giving you the honest answer, it's a lot more today than it used to be. I bet you at least every day. I mean, yeah, maybe not like in person if I don't see anybody, but usually texts or, but if I see people, it's pretty often. Where it started getting a little bit weird is when we'd go on vacation to places like, we're not from Colorado, Florida. We were down in Mexico last week and some people came up to me at the pool. My wife thinks it's funny. All I can say is the power of podcasts is so big and you never know where it's actually reaching. I'm constantly blown away by who has listened to it. And it's one of the best things I've ever done. I love doing it, but it's an incredibly powerful tool. And so it's been a lot of fun, but more lately.
Well, I can honestly say that I feel like you are the leader in at least our industry in real estate. And so if I've copied anything with respect to my podcast, it's attributed to the Fort. So what do they say, that imitation is the highest form of flattery?
I love it. And you can copy all you want, because that's all I've done is just copy other people and what they've done. It's nothing's too original.
That's great. Well, let's get into it. I know you were generous of having me on your podcast a couple months ago, albeit on some, you know, sobering circumstances with our good friend Artem and his passing, and that podcast with me and Zach Strait from Way Capital, hopefully was impactful to your listeners and to your audience. We're going through challenging times, and now it's close to 2 years now of really a, what I call a choppy transactional market. What have the last, you know, couple years been for you and Fort Capital?
Yeah. First off, that was an incredible episode. I'm not here to plug my podcast, but if anybody hasn't listened to it, they really should. The feedback was incredible. We talked about a lot of important things and for a really important reason. And so that was a great episode just on kind of what happens if you get in trouble in this business. What's been going on the last 2 years? I was literally just on a phone call before I talked to you, and I was telling somebody, he's in oil and gas. I said, I don't think you guys realize it, but we're almost at the 2 year anniversary of kind of a different change in the market. And to be honest with you, we're 2 years in, and like, I guess I would say, in our view of the world, so we'd buy shallow bay light industrial kind of class B product throughout Texas and the Sun Belt. So I'm kind of going to speak today on that. I'm not in, like, there's other parts of real estate that are maybe doing better, and there's certainly ones that are doing worse, but I can tell you kind of my view of the world. Everything, and maybe categorically, not just our view of the world, it's all been slow for 2 years, some slower than others. Our slice of the world's been interesting because the performance of our properties has really continued to chug along. I mean, we have several deals that are much better than we ever expected. Rents generally are up. They were up 18 to 22% across our whole portfolio in 23. Tours remain super active. I mean, the economy's doing pretty well. I mean, there's pockets where it's not. And so what you have in our world is nobody really needs to sell. Everybody's just been kind of standing idle, waiting to see what's going to happen. And if you are selling right now, it's definitely not a distressed situation. I mean, I don't think I've seen a distressed Class B industrial deal in years, but certainly not through this kind of cycle. And so it's just been very slow. I mean, to put it in perspective, 19 through 20, mid 22, we were averaging 12 deals a year. The last deal we closed was 8 months ago, and we have nothing under contract right now. We've made 97 offers this year.
You say this year, 97 offers in 3 months?
Yeah. We're wow. Firing four or five. Our game right now is offer on everything. Just get LOIs in people's inbox. They're serious offers. These are deals we're underwriting. And at least be top of mind if somebody, if the gap's starting to close. But we're just going to continue shooting shots. We haven't gotten any accepted. We haven't stretched at all. And it's been really slow around here. Now we have a lot working, and I feel like we're getting kind of closer to that moment where things are going to start happening. The sentiment in the market seems to be shifting a little bit. I don't know if you're feeling that, Andrew. It sounds like, you know, Goldman and Blackstone came out last week and they said it's time. I'm not saying that means it's time, but that's the first time in 2 years you've seen a really brand name say it's time. Now, off the backs of that, there were some other firms that said it's not time, but they're not Blackstone or Goldman. Those tend to be kind of blue chip names that people follow. So I feel like the sentiment is starting to build. I mean, after 2 years, people have money to put out. Things are been slow. The animal spirits are building. But look, interest rates are high. Like, you can get as excited as you want, and if interest rates stay where they're at, the math kind of has to work. Or you go into this negative leverage world where I feel like in some other asset classes, especially like single tenant deals, you know, small single tenant deals, you're starting to see some kind of 5.5 cap deals get done, some lower cap rate deals. You're also seeing debt is starting to creep down a little bit more. But everything's kind of in a stalemate still. At least in our world, but it seems like, I don't know how to say it. It just feels like things are trending. Like, maybe we bottomed.
I would say that. I would say in the last 30 days, we have seen a noticeable uptick in LOIs that our clients have presented us, transactions for us to work on. Have we been busy over the last 2 years? Yes, but it's not the same type of busy, right?
Yeah.
From workouts and working through issues, being more defensive, less offensive. You know, curious, you know, the Fed, as we're recording this and the day after the Fed met and said they're keeping rates the same, but alluded to possibly three decreases in rates over the remainder of 24. And I was with actually some YPOers yesterday in the Southern California region, and they said, that's great and all, and maybe not related to industrial, but from their view, they just don't think that's going to be sufficient to work out what is necessary in order to save a lot of people. That it's nice, but we're still going to be at a world of hurt come the end of this year. What's your perspective on sort of what the Fed has broadcasted or intimated that they're going to do?
Oh man. In some regards, okay, look, a lot of people would say, well, just listen to the Fed. They've done what they said they're going to do. And it's like, yes, after they went to zero interest rates and told us they weren't raising and that inflation was transitory, then they started saying, so they were like, we're going to keep them low. Don't worry. But if you followed them since then, they've kind of done what they said they're going to do. The inflation print, I think it was last week, came up a little higher than expected. You know, there's this philosophy, if you track back through history, that usually when inflation hits, it's a spike, then it drops. There's one more massive spike, and then it drops, and then it kind of holds steady. And people would say, well, what causes the second spike? And I'm not a history buff. I haven't spent a ton of time on this, but it's along the lines of if you've been priced into long-term contracts you haven't had a chance to reset your pricing yet, there's a lot of contracts that still haven't had pricing reset. And so they've been locked into, so what's going to happen is contracts will expire throughout the year, and there's still like this next lift on all these contracts that haven't been able to kind of keep up with inflation. Contracts all across the business world. And so what you usually see is this final leg of people repricing into today's market so they can get their margin back if they you know, their expenses have continued to rise. And so you'll see the second wave of inflation. Now, I don't know if that'll happen again. History sometimes rhymes. It doesn't always necessarily repeat itself. But if that's a thought. And I don't know about you, but I just like left spring break, and I will tell you, nothing feels cheaper. In fact, everything felt a lot more expensive. But behind that is this. And look, I'm going to steal this from Barry Sternlicht, who was on my podcast a few weeks ago. And he was like, look, government jobs aren't impacted by interest rates. Healthcare jobs aren't impacted by interest rates. Education jobs aren't impacted by interest rates. It, like, the whole economy isn't really impacted. And he goes, usually the industry that you're looking to kind of topple over is the construction industry. And in most situations, high interest rates would do that. But what's happening right now is all the big construction companies that were 70% private, 30% public on their jobs, it's now just flipped. It's 30-70 because let's not forget the government had a $6 trillion infrastructure bill. So the interest rates, you're like pushing on a string almost. You go talk to the contractors around DFW, they're busier than ever. And oh, by the way, guess who's paying their bills? The government. Who pays the most? The government. So you have all this labor that usually would be laid off that's not only getting laid off, but they're getting like paid better to go work for the government. So what's that going to do on private pricing when you want them to go back into the private world? It just puts this weird pressure. And so, look, I'm kind of copying what somebody else said, but it really made a lot of sense. So all that to be said, maybe interest rates are going to go down a few points. Maybe they're not. We'll see. You're right. I think if you're in a tight situation already, three cuts by the end of the year probably ain't going to save you. It's going to help. Yeah. But if you're not already with some healthy margin, I don't think three cuts gets you there.
It's certainly not going to help the multifamily borrower where they either don't have a rate cap because they started at such a low interest rate. And even those that had a rate cap and they're expiring, the cost to extend that rate cap is 10, 15 times what it cost 2 to 3 years ago. And as cap rates have risen, the prospects of them refinancing out of what they currently have is daunting. It's daunting.
Yep.
And so we hear it doesn't really apply to private money and private lenders, but we are hearing that the federal government is, you know, telling the agencies, you got to work things out with your borrowers. We can't have massive foreclosures here, especially in the multifamily world. Now, I don't think that's not applicable in other commercial aspects of real estate. Look, in office, you know, we've seen the effects, the significant effects coming out of COVID, and the way people utilize office has really just pummeled that asset class. We've talked about multifamily. It feels that industrial is in a safe spot here. Sure, you could be nitpicky that, you know, rents have come down a bit and the market's a little softer, but overall, how do you feel about the industrial market?
Like, it's chugging along right now. And I can speak to kind of the class B, but even the class A stuff in DFW, which I keep a pulse on, is leasing up. I think there's, at one point, there was 26 1 million square foot buildings going up across DFW. I was told yesterday there's three left in the market. And what you're also going to see, though, in every asset class is a supply glut's coming. So every deal that's coming on market was started 3 years ago, but nothing's starting right now. So you'll see deliveries continue, but nothing will start in 24, 25. You probably won't see stuff starting until maybe 26, 27 again. So any short-term pain is kind of going to be made up in a few years because supply is stopping in multi, it's stopping in industrial. I mean, office is no, I mean, they're not going to build much more of that. I don't know if that answered your question. Back to industrial. The markets that we're in are moving along. And again, most industrial was capitalized with fairly moderate debt. In our case, I think 85% of our portfolio is fixed rate debt. So we kind of start rolling through that beginning of 25. We sold a lot in 21 and 20. So those deals that would have been maturing now, those got off our books. But everything most stuff's financed 60, 65. A lot of the syndicators were using high leverage bridge debt, trying to add value and get to a permanent agency loan as quickly as possible. That's not the model in industrial. Now, and I can't speak for developers. I think there are probably some developers out there finishing up buildings that, you know, they're going to have to recap into a higher interest rate environment, and they might get stuck a little bit. But nobody's really hurting. They're not hurting from empty buildings and no tenants. They're just hurting from interest rates. And so everybody can kind of wrap their head around that a little bit more than they can a market where you don't know if a tenant's going to show up to lease your building for the next couple of years. The math is pretty easy on like, hey, tenant here paying this, rates are here. Investors can kind of solve for it a little bit better as opposed to tons of fear about, will a tenant ever lease this building? Should we just let it go? So, and look, I think where the world, the things that shape industrial and are driving industrial, those forces are still at play and those tailwinds are growing. Everybody wants to hear about Amazon. They're kind of back to gaining steam again. A lot of the big boys are back to gaining steam. And in what we do in Class B Industrial, which is a lot of service-based businesses, a lot of local medium-sized businesses, cities are still growing. I mean, again, economies are good. And so those tenants are still in business. You're not seeing business bankruptcies or foreclosures. You're just seeing high interest rates. I don't know how to say it.
Yeah. So pivoting the conversation, you know, me being in LA, you being in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, over the last couple of years, especially since COVID, the narrative has been this exodus of people from California, whether it's Southern California, Northern California, just invading Texas, whether it's Dallas, Austin. Anecdotally, I have several friends who have moved to both regions. When you're walking around the streets of Dallas, is it just, have you been invaded by folks from California? Do you see it? Do you notice it? Is it palpable, or is it just more anecdotal?
Yeah. Austin, a lot more so. I'm not from Austin, but I would tell you a lot of people of my friends in Austin, I think, feel it. And look, I was at a family office at Old Parkland the other day, group that moved here from San Francisco. They'll never go back. There is a lot of California money, and I will tell you, like, it's really impacted the housing prices. Like, you see it because Californians look at what they can get in Texas. I know we have higher property taxes, but yeah, you have felt it in Dallas. Not everybody's from California, but more people than you would think. So they're here, but like, it's not as everything's going to feel bigger in the news. It's not probably what you think about, but it's definitely more. And what I would tell you is, like, they love it. I think they're always kind of surprised. They're like, it's just, again, it's two different cultures. It's two different ways of living. But I'm always like, well, what do you think about it? They're like, people say hi and stuff, like when you're walking down the street, and like, it's not weird. And I'm like, yeah, it's not. I don't know a different life. I've been here my whole life, but
yeah,
they seem to be adjusting well. I don't know if they like it or not.
There was this spoof, I think during COVID or just coming out of COVID, where a California family just moved to Texas, and there was a husband and wife who came up, rang the doorbell, and the Californians who were in the house were like, oh my God, someone's coming, call the police, who's coming over? And then they opened up the door, and it was just a
it was like the neighbor bringing like cookies and like yeah. Welcome to the neighborhood. Yeah.
But
no, so all the Californians I've met are awesome. That's all I'm going to say. They've all been great. So, and I think they are moving here. They definitely are.
Well, that's good to know. It's something we consider in my household. But what now there's a narrative, because so many of my clients, although they're California based, they are transacting and have been transacting for the last several years in the Sun Belt, from Phoenix, Vegas, throughout Texas, Florida, Nashville, Atlanta, Carolinas. And now over the last, I don't know, 60 days plus, maybe a couple more months, there's a narrative where there's a concern of oversupply and an endless ability to develop in these communities, where it's easier to develop compared to Southern California or really anywhere in California, and that there's a renewed focus in California or in states where it's more supply constrained. I mean, when we had our transfer tax ULA come online over a year ago, we had clients in the private equity world and other capital providers who literally put a red line through LA and said, we will not transact in LA because of this repulsive 5.5% transfer tax. But now there is this talk about, gosh, I'm really getting hurt in some of these other states. Maybe I should look back to California. And I know your focus is Texas and the Sun Belt, but are you concerned about oversupply in some of these markets?
In my asset class, and again, I'm not talking my book, the stuff we buy, they're not building in any of the markets because it's 80s, 90s vintage. It's in the loop. It's got different dynamics. Now, I was in Nashville yesterday. Nashville is delivering over the next like 18 months, like 20% of their apartment stock. I mean, it's the largest in the country. Apparently, there's like new deals in Nashville that are offering 4 or 5 months free rent. Now, Nashville is booming. I mean, it was an awesome time. I loved it. I got to tour the city. It was great, but there's so much coming online that it was interesting. Austin following the same dynamics. Austin's housing market and residential market, it's probably a short-term thing. They'll fill out eventually, but they were built as if the growth was just never going to stop, and that definitely changed. I don't think your narrative is off. I think now people are going, all right, you know, it's tough to develop in some of these constricted markets and some of the, you know, it's just harder to develop in Southern California than it is, but there might be, there's, it's worth the brain damage and the value, because we're not having to worry about everybody else coming out of the ground. But no, I think there's certainly, especially in the multifamily space, reason to be concerned in some of these Sunbelt markets.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's dive into Fort Capital here for a bit. And you know, just going on your website, you know, $2 billion plus in total transactions, over 24 million of square feet transacted, 400 million of equity raised, you have 1,000 investors. I mean, that's quite an accomplishment. And how talk about that, you know, one thing that we don't hear, or maybe on your podcast, but I think that my podcast listeners would like to know, you know, how did you start Fort Capital and grow it to the size that it is today? And we probably need about 5 hours to answer that question, but.
No, I kind of pinch myself when I hear the numbers like that. It's kind of crazy because I started buying rental houses my freshman year of college. So for me, it just started with one rental property and a big dream and a lot of ambition. I don't lack ambition. I started buying rental houses my freshman year of college. This was 2004. And the short story is it's all I've ever done is keep building time after time. I think what I would tell you is there's two stories to Fort Capital. There was Fort Capital before my partner Jason and I existed, which was me. You know, I grew it. I was doing lots of deals, you know, did it through college, after college, started developing stuff. And I was just a deal junkie, had learned to raise money. But really in like 2015, you know, we probably had a team of 12 or 15 people at that point. We were doing all types of development, student housing, multifamily, single family, land development. We bought some multifamily, some retail. We really woke up one day and we just said, we are really busy and we're making money, but it felt like you were kind of just treading water. Like you were working so hard. And really all I'm getting to is we had a lack of focus. We were so ambitious, like we knew we would work, but we weren't really gaining the ground we wanted to. And through some wisdom, through a few things, talking to potential recruits, we started realizing like great people wanted to work for a company where they kind of knew what they were working on. For a long time, I was like, you get to work on everything. Every day is a surprise. That kind of sounds fun, but it's not fun for like people that want to build a career. And the second was equity. We would go pitch them a townhome deal and needed $5 million for it. And they would kind of give us the same thing. They were like, look, we think you'll make money. You're a hustler. You've kind of proven you've got, but we want to give money to the group that builds townhomes all day, every day, and just gets better at that. And we don't know if you're going to wake up tomorrow thinking about student housing or land, or so we pass. And so it was pretty quick. It didn't take much those meetings to go, we probably need to find something to focus on. And so I'm happy to go into it or not, but we basically said, okay, we're going to do that. I spent the year kind of figuring out what are we going to go all in on? It wasn't so obvious. And the irony is we picked Class B industrial, which is something we had actually never done before. It's almost like we had done everything but that.
Wow.
And we got to it by looking at the macro environment, thinking this is something that could probably is undervalued right now. And then what do you not want to do? We didn't want to develop anymore. Development's really hard. There's a lot of risk that you can't control. It's a lumpy fee business that's not kind of steady and recurring. There was just lots of things we didn't want based on our experience. And then we picked something that we felt like had legs. And so at the end of our 2015 year-end retreat, Jason and I looked at each other and we made a pact and we said, we're going to go all in on Class B industrial. Not one deal we do from here going forward is going to be different. We'll finish all of the legacy stuff that we've been doing. And that took till probably 2018, but everything new coming into the company will be this. And I think the first year in 2016, we did like one or two industrial deals. Now we were busy because we had legacy development going on, but I will tell you the best thing we ever did for our company was focus deeply on one thing and get really good at it. And most of the numbers that you just talked about really some of that was pre-focus, but a lot of that has been the last 7 or 8 years of industrial.
Was there a seminal transaction or a seminal moment where you said to your partner, we made the right decision?
Yeah, so we're really big at Ford. So we read the book Good to Great. So my partner's an incredible CEO. He's just an awesome operator. I'm very fortunate to have him. And he had been at a big company before we met. He's 10 years older than I am. And he had been the second largest privately held home builder in the country. They win Culture of the Year every year and had just built an amazing operating machine that cranked out homes, and they were very profitable through all market cycles. So anyway, when he showed up with me, he just met some like entrepreneur running around town just trying to put stuff together. He was kind of like, well, let's build an actual company, which for anybody that's built a company, it's fun, but it's not that fun. Like the day-to-day of it is not glamorous. I think the headlines are glamorous, but it's not glamorous to build a company. And I mean that in the nicest way possible. We have the best people. I love our team. I love what we do. But like the hour by hour, day by day, most business is like, it's like you win the Super Bowl, which is what you get. But the 350 days of eating dirt at practice aren't as fun as winning the Super Bowl. Anyway, you asked like, what were the inflection points? Jason said, I'm going to hang back and build the company. You go continue to raise capital, find deals, bring opportunity in. So that was one. And the second was, if you've read Good to Great, you've thought of the flywheel concept, or you've heard of the flywheel concept. We really settled into, we did a retreat in like 2017, a big on retreats, love a good one day offsite. I think they're like the best things company can do. And we said, we need a flywheel. We spent all day figuring out what our flywheel was. And for anybody listening, a flywheel is something that over time you start early on by putting a lot of effort into pushing it and making it go round. But over time, if you do that well enough, it builds momentum, and the effort to move the flywheel gets less and less. What you're basically saying is you can do more with less effort. And we went all in on this flywheel, and we said everything we do, every goal we set, everything we work on, if it's not pushing that flywheel forward, we're not going to work on it. And that's easy to say. What you find in a lot of companies is they get more successful. They start having ideas and they want to do things. And like the most exciting part of it is the idea. But if you're like, well, how does this actually make our company gain momentum? It doesn't. And so what does anything you do outside of your flywheel do to your company? It slows your company down. You're really busy and it feels good, but you're not gaining momentum. I think Amazon has the most famous flywheel of all time, and it's very simple. So we knew what ours was, and we knew these are the only things we're going to do. And I could go on and on about how great that was, but we knew what our flywheel was. Our team knew what it was. And we said, if you aren't doing something that's pushing this flywheel forward, don't bring it to us. We're not interested in doing it. Yeah. And that was an inflection point. Yeah, and then just scale. Yeah. You buy enough of this stuff, you can charge enough fees and hire enough people. And buying more real estate and getting scale helps solves a lot of problems across the board as you're building a great company.
Yeah. It's interesting because a good segment of my client base is similar to you and Fort Capital, in that you have focused on one asset class and in a particular region, Texas, Sunbelt. And then I have other clients who they view themselves as just finding great opportunities regardless of the asset class and almost regardless of location. And I'm amazed at how they're able to attract capital because they can't say that they're an expert in that particular asset class or region because they're spread out, but yet they've been successful. So it shows that you can be successful in multiple ways, but I would assume selecting the asset class, selecting a region, you can become a master at that at that asset class and locations, and therefore can honestly say to capital that you are the best or one of the best in owning, operating, and in your case, Class B industrial.
And for us, like And you're absolutely right. I mean, so what I'm also not saying we can only buy Class B industrial forever. What I now you look at our company 8 years later, we have scale, we've built a platform, we've built a process that we trust and we know works. Whether you're buying self-storage or multi, like it changes a little bit, but 90% of it we've mastered, which is the process. How do you buy stuff, ingest it, operate it, report to investors, raise capital, market yourself? I mean, it's kind of, you just go around, how do you hire people? How do you find people? How do you build teams? We've kind of done all that. And so now we could say, yeah, we're going to start buying multi too without disturbing the system. It's now just another part of the system. But if we had started the journey like we did early on, it's like, well, we're going to just do all these things. We would have never really figured out what's it like to master something. Once you know what it's like to really master something, and I'm not saying that we've mastered Class B industrial, that we've gotten really damn good at it. And we know what it's like. I would say
the track record shows that you're really good.
And I would just say we know what it's like to be really damn good at something. And so anybody's view of excellence is only relative to the excellence they've been a part of. So like, I can't imagine what Elon Musk thinks excellence looks like. Like my level of excellence might be here. Elon's is so, I can't even imagine what he believes is excellent work because I've never experienced it yet. Same with Amazon. You look at the early pictures of Jeff Bezos. He's on the floor, like packing boxes and, you know, whatever he was doing. That was his level of excellence until he built like the trolley system or whatever that got packaged. And that was the new level of excellence. So I think the way we think about it is we think we're excellent at something. And so now we know how to apply it to something else without disturbing the other thing. But I think we had to give ourselves that time to learn how to build the machine. And then you can start kind of adding in things to it over time without creating disruption.
I think I'm going to put that excellence comment or statement on a bumper sticker and
you should.
it's a good saying. Have you
noticed?
Think
about it this way: if all you've ever had is eaten is ramen noodles your whole life, if I said what's excellent food, you would just say the ramen that had chicken in it. But if I then took you for one night for the best steak ever, the best steak there is in LA, and I said the next day, okay, tell me what excellence is, the bar's reset again. It's whatever you've experienced.
No, it's a great perspective. Curious if you're seeing more groups enter the industrial market, especially where office is now. So several of my office clients have pivoted to industrial.
Everybody is getting into industrial.
Yeah, even multifamily. I know.
It was like a meme. Our friend Elliot B on Twitter, it's like a meme that he does now. It's everybody's just ditching whatever they were doing and getting into Class B industrial. We have seen when we started in 2016, people were like, what are you doing? Like, why are you buying these sheds? They're ugly. they're like, I remember the first few years, people were like, you're nuts. And look, it's like all things. When you're early into something, it seems a little weird. But yeah, everybody and their mother, it seems like, is getting into industrial in some way, shape, or form, which, again, that's good and bad. It's good because I guess it keeps pricing high. It's bad because it's harder to find deals and do deals. So if you've already been in for a while, it's good, but it just makes it tougher to crack into the market. But the other thing I can say is, look, we've been in it for 8 years. We've built a reputation. We have an advantage over all the incumbents. The only thing new incumbents really have to offer over us is more money to buy, to pay more than we are, if they're going to crack into it. And so, but yes, everybody's getting into industrial, it seems like.
Yeah. Well, in our remaining time, I want to talk about how you're capitalizing deals and if that has shifted over the last several years. I noticed on your website, 1,000 investors. So that would say to me, either in a fund model or a syndication model. Curious if you've taken any JV money. So if you could just talk about how you guys capitalize deals from the equity side.
Yep. And to finish that last note, leading into capital, most of the reason why people are getting into industrial is because the only capital out in the market right now is for industrial and multifamily. There is no capital, you know, there's capital for other things, but it pushes you that way. We've syndicated every deal by deal for 18 years. That wasn't some like brilliant strategy. That's just what we did. We started passing the hat around when I was 21 years old, raising $500,000, $1 million for a deal, and then 2 million. And over time, you just keep making people money and proving what you're going to do. And you keep meeting more people. We've never solicited anybody. So we've never like gone and pitched somebody on why they should invest with us. Now we've sent them a deal and said, do you want to invest? But we don't have a sales team. It's all pretty much inbound referrals. And that's worked really well. We've syndicated like $460 million. And I will tell you right now, we're in the market trying to raise our first dedicated vehicle. I don't know exactly what that will end up looking like structure-wise, but we think we're at a place, 21, 22, we syndicated a couple hundred million bucks a year. I think we did 150, then we did 200. It becomes a lot. And to be really competitive, there's advantages. The cost of capital is cheaper. Your deals aren't crossed. But to grow at the pace that we want to grow, we committed capital is going to help. Again, cost of capital will get a little more expensive. We're still trying to keep it all uncrossed. We're working on that. But we've been out in the market for 12 months looking at talking to groups about what that would look like. And the reason for an uncrossed vehicle for us, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, it's advantageous. You can sell a deal and make money. You don't have to sell 10 deals to make money. Our company culture is built off being able to sell and generate promote. That's how people have been paid forever. So to go back to our team and say, you're now going to get paid every 5 to 7 years instead of every whenever we sell something, that just changes. You can recruit better when you're deal by deal, or at least have promote by promote, or so we're told. And I will just say unequivocally, some of the giants in the industry, I'm a little peon compared to these people. When I asked them, what's one thing I shouldn't give up, almost unequivocally, like they don't have to think about it very hard. Don't, if you cannot cross your deals, don't do that. Pay a little more, take a little less promote, pay a higher pref, don't cross your deals.
Is that possible? I mean, how has the investor market received that, you know, request or that demand that you have?
It's a really good question. It is possible. There's structures to do it. You can do like a GP fund style, but in a GP fund, you still have to raise the LP equity every time you want to do a deal. So there's that. So you don't truly have fully committed. But if you raise enough of a GP fund, you can still you can get a line of credit and still like execute the deal and then backfill it after you close. So that's one way to do it. There are hybrid models where you can raise a big fund and just say, look, we're just going to put that fund into 15 different deals. And it's like syndicating without having to syndicate. You're getting it up front and you're just telling people, we'll never put more than X amount in each deal, but we're going to layer it in deal by deal. You could do it that way. You can create kind of synthetic promotes, even in a closed in structure that can pay off. Your team can get paid, even if like me and Jason don't get paid. That's not as fun. I don't like that one as much, but it's a way to keep my team paid, which is what I care about. I want my team always incentivized. If they're incentivized to do well, things will typically work out. I mean, that's how you would do it. And all I would tell you is the last thing is a lot of people would say, okay, that's more of an entrepreneurial model. Or you become what they call a fund business, where you just raise a fund, then raise a bigger fund and another fund, and you're on fund 15, and you're what's called an institutional fund business. I'll tell you, Andrew, I wouldn't say I have no desire to do that. I don't ever want to totally shut the door to that. It's not why I got into the business. That's a different form of running a company. I'm not against it. But I'm going to fight to not have to go that direction for a bit longer.
Yeah, no, I get it. But how is the market, how is it fundraising in today's market when, you know, it is challenging for anybody to raise money on a single deal, but for you with respect to a fund itself, I mean, we've formed a lot of funds over the last 12 to 24 months. It's been hard for our clients to raise money in this market.
Yeah, I would say nobody's in a rush to do anything. Now, I'm not Blackstone. I'm not like blue chip the best. I'm sure they could, no matter what the market is, they can just gobble it all up. So I'm speaking to like a lower middle market company. Unless you have some incredibly unique opportunity that's so unique and profitable, which I haven't really heard of many, so I would imagine those might be getting funded. Nobody's in a rush. I would tell you, everybody's taking meetings again. I mean, we've met with over 60 groups in the last 4 months. We hired JLL to take us through this process, and we have had a ton of meetings. So back to where we said, like, the animal spirits are building up. It seems like people are getting ready to move a little bit quicker again. And generally speaking, it's been an incredible learning experience, learned a lot. I think we're going to get term sheets. I think we'll get several term sheets, but it has, when I started this, I was told it's going to take 12 to 18 months. And even though we've raised $460 million of equity, when you're raising a fund, everybody sometimes treats you like you're, it's like you're back to being a rookie again, which is fine. I mean, it's like a first time fund.
Yep. Totally.
We're at this unique size where we're like, yeah, we kind of skipped fund one and two. We're kind of starting where most fund three people are, but the world doesn't necessarily care about that. So I would tell you, I don't know. I've never raised a fund in a really great time where cash is moving. I've syndicated, so I know how quickly it was to raise that. But my guess is it's slower than normal, and it's going to take all of 12 to 18 months to get it done. Now, don't get me started on, I don't think it has to take 12 to 18 months, but it does. But that's not what we're going to talk about now.
No, we don't need to. But my last substantive question is, have you ever considered joint venture structures where a capital provider puts up the vast majority of the equity?
Yes. And the only issue with that, it's all timing. If every seller on the planet would give me 120 days to close, I might never do a fund. I'd just joint venture everything. Mm-hmm. The problem is when you have a good deal on the line and you have a 30-day look and a 30-day close, and let's be honest, everybody takes as long as they can to get that contract signed so you can buy an extra 10 or 15 days. It's just the name of the game.
Oh, of course. You know how many times clients have said, hey, Kirsch, make sure you have built momentum so it looks like we're making progress, but not too quick so you can buy another week or two for me, Mike. I got
send
it.
You the turn of the document Friday afternoon.
Yep.
So we know we bought the weekend, but the truth is that's the problem. So if I'm going to a JV partner that I've never done a deal with, just the process of meeting them, pitching them the deal, they have to take it to their investment committee. They have to ask questions and they have to go back to their investment committee. The big boys, it's a logistical problem. It's a logistics problem. And so, now, obviously, if you've done a deal with somebody, you have a relationship and you can kind of repeat. That's a great deal. I think one thing we've been nervous about is a JV where you're beholden to one partner and they have thumbs up, thumbs down. And so if they don't want to do it, you have to go meet a new partner, which again takes time. And if I have a deal in hand, I don't have time to go meet a new partner because I got to perform. But yes, I would love to do joint ventures and I would love to just have a little more time to close, but that's not the name of the game. And that's not how you win deals when you need 90 days to close. So it's kind of, we're in a chicken and an egg problem there. We haven't done enough of them to have enough partners where I could send them a deal tomorrow and get approval in 7 days.
I've had clients who have done billions of dollars of deals through a joint venture structure and have then pivoted to a fund model. And I said, why are you doing this? And they said, because the brokers will take me more seriously if I have committed capital than if I have to raise it even though, despite my track record of having a great track record with institutional JVs, they're going to favor the fund model.
For sure. I don't know if that ever changes, but it's the right thing. I mean, the crazy thing, I probably shouldn't say this. The craziest thing is when sellers ask us, where's your equity come from? We tell them, we're going to syndicate it, but we've never not syndicated it. You can count on that. It's kind of, the irony is, it's not that we would never sell to a syndicator, but we always ask, where's your capital coming from? Like we scrutinize the syndicator more, because, or even the JV partner. Because if you don't truly have it, you have to ask the question, are you sure you're going to get it? Because I don't want to waste 30 days, because time kills deals. And if I got to go to buyer two again and say, you got the deal, especially in a market like right now, they're like, yeah. And the price just went down a little bit.
They smell blood. All right. Final question here. We're recording this on what I consider one of the greatest sports days of the year, the start of March Madness. And if I, if I recall correctly, you're a big TCU fan.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a commonality between you and me right here. You went to TCU. TCU's a 9 seed. Northwestern, which is where I went, also a 9 seed. Let's have a wager. Whoever's 9 seed goes further, the other buys them dinner. Okay?
Deal.
All right. You got
now
you
I have a reason to now I'm more invested. I didn't do a bracket this year, but now I've got this to look forward to.
All right. So it's TCU versus Northwestern. We're not playing each other, but whoever goes further in the tournament, they get dinner.
Deal.
Meaning the loser has to buy the other dinner. All right.
I'm good for that.
Perfect. Well, Chris, I really appreciate you coming on to the show, being so candid and open. You're always that way in our conversations, with your podcast. And I'm glad my audience, which is a fraction of the Fort's audience, got to hear about your history and your perspective on industrial real estate. So, Chris, thank you for coming on. And hopefully you'll be buying me dinner, because it meant Northwestern went further than TCU.
My pleasure, man. This was awesome. You do a great show, and it's always good to be with you, man. I've really enjoyed our time together.
All right, Chris. Be well. Thank you.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.